Hello and welcome to the RCP Medicine Podcast, a clinical cases episode where we give you the tools to deal with clinical conundrums. I am Dr. Rohan Mehra, an RCP Clinical Education Fellow and an Infectious Diseases and Microbiology Registrar. And today we will be discussing the painfully common consequence of trying to go on holiday for a relaxing break, only to encounter some terrible pathogen you end up bringing home to your local A&E. That's right, it's fever in the returning traveller, a challenge for everyone involved. And joining us to discuss our case today is Dr. Alex Q. Alex is an infectious diseases and microbiology consultant at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases and Royal Free NHS Trust. His specialist interests include bites, stings, and parasitology, having studied zoology and further animal-related injury research at the Natural History Museum and Imperial College London. Alex is also passionate about education and is microbiology training lead at the Royal Free. So without further ado, welcome Alex.
Hi, how are you all doing? Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very excited to be on.
Thanks for joining. I mean, instantly I know who I'll be sending the next photo of a bite I get on holiday to. So that's always very useful as a straight off the bat.
About to say, that's the absolutely constant flurry of pictures of various injuries, bites and swellings of people's skin that flood my inboxes. So that's absolutely fine.
So before we dive right into the case, I want to emphasise that our plan today is to demonstrate via this case a stepwise approach that anyone can use to help diagnose and manage a patient who presents as a fever in the returning traveller. At least that's our aim, isn't it, Alex?
Yeah, that's the aim, is to try and get people to kind of think about, you know, this is a common occurrence in A&Es, even for infection doctors, but non-infection doctors. So the aim is to try and give a sort of framework of how do you even start thinking about this stuff, and why has the infection team you've called asked you to ask lots of very weird sounding questions? I'll try and explain why you've just asked, has that person ever seen a cave? And it is actually relevant to various problems.
Perfect. So let's see this plan in action then. Firstly, Alex, as I tend to do to any consultant who comes on this podcast, I'm going to demote you back to being the reg on call. You know, you thought you'd got out of those days, but sadly, you're back being the reg with the referrals bleep. And you get a call from ED. So you have a 27-year-old male who presents with a 10-day history of fever, which was followed by some diarrhea, vomiting and abdominal pain. And he's returned from Pakistan. And I'll give you a little bit more of the history. Initially, the first thing that the patient noticed was a fever. And then 72 hours later, he developed some diarrhea and vomiting with some abdominal pain. And he put this all down to the fact that he'd eaten some burfi, which is a sweet that he had brought home with him from Pakistan and kept unrefrigerated. But these symptoms continued to progress over the next 7 days, and they became so bad that the patient felt they couldn't really cope any longer, wasn't really keeping anything down. Even water had become difficult for them to keep down, and had spent most of the last 3 days in bed, apart from some trips to the bathroom. So just having heard that little intro, what are immediate thoughts and what do you want to do next?
What a lovely intro and case. So for all the infection specialists out there, you should be screaming what you think the diagnosis might be into your various podcast listening devices. But for any non-infectious specialists, some of you should recognize a few key points of that history, which I think if we follow our lovely framework might become more relevant as we go through. But there's a few key history points in that very quick, succinct summary already that might push you down certain diagnostic pathway. But before even we go to that, I thought we should have a think about, well, let's just say that I didn't even get that much history. Let's say the ED consultant just called me and said, 27-year-old fever, and that was it. And how you should start thinking about the syndromes that might present this way. So we said 27-year-old, 10 days, let's just say fever, and I don't even know about the diarrhea. We define febrile illnesses or acute undifferentiated febrile illnesses as a fever of less than 2 weeks. So this fits with this case. And we normally define it without organ-specific symptoms at the onset. Now, in our case, we have diarrhea, which might push us more towards the GI tract. But often lots of illnesses have no specific symptoms. So the classic phone call to you in A&E as the medical SHO, F1 registrar would be headache, chills, myalgia. So that's not that helpful. Now, obviously, as diseases progress, organs can become involved, but that's the sort of classification. And we as infection doctors tend to think about serious travel-related infections based on how common and how serious they are. So that's the first thing to say. Lots of people that used to teach me who are still working right now, and if they listen, they'll know who I'm talking about. If you hear hooves, you don't go for the zebra. Unfortunately, in infectious diseases, you get quite a few zebras. So that doesn't quite work, but you tend to want to think about the horses first, and maybe the zebras come into it afterwards. The horses for your returning fever and travelers are things like, and the thing that everyone should be thinking about, and the diagnosis that I ask all my registrars to think of immediately, and anyone coming back from a tropical country with fever, is, Dr. Rohan,
malaria.
Malaria, exactly. I don't think you were prepared for me to be questioning you on a podcast when I'm the guest.
No, but I got it right and it's all okay.
Yeah, so exactly. So it's all good. We can edit out each of the wrong answers afterwards. So malaria. And actually, when you look at lots of publications and speak to lots of infection consultants, much smarter infection consultants than I, lots of the differentials will commonly revolve around malaria. And that's because malaria kills people. It's severe and it can present very non-specifically. So obviously you want to think about malaria because your first differential, anyone coming back from a malaria country, and whether or not this could be, because you can treat it, it's treatable. And so it's one of the diseases you should be thinking about. This is probably out of date, but the last one I looked at, these lovely ranges for infectious diseases, you're thinking about kind of 20 to 50% of all fevers in adults from Asia and Africa. This is undifferentiated fevers end up being malaria. So, as I said, hooves, horses. So you want to start thinking about malaria and all the questions that's come along there. But there are other infections that are common, some of which might be more relevant to this case. And so once you've thought about malaria and whether someone's taking things to prevent malaria or whether it fits with malaria, you might be thinking about the other kind of what I tell my registrars, the big six or big five. Some other consultants will define it a different way. And there's lots of various mnemonics. The one that I've seen in a very useful publication, which I'll talk about at the end, is called MAESR. So that is MAESR. So that's a useful mnemonic to think about your big five causes of undifferentiated fever. So the M we've just spoken about is malaria. A, what do we think about A?
Arbovirus.
Arbovirus, yeah. So arboviral infections, very common. We think around 17% of kind of febrile illnesses from Asia and Africa. And that includes illnesses like dengue, chikungunya, Zika, et cetera, et cetera. All right. So that's your A. E counts for enteric fever, which might be a bit of a clue for this case, but we won't go into that. S is spirochetes. You're thinking about the common one that I've found lots of infection, non-infectious specialists love to point out as their top kind of weird infection is leptospirosis. So that's the kind of common one thrown out. And R is your rickettsial infections. So you're thinking stuff like scrub typhus. So that's just a very easy mnemonic, a very easy way of remembering kind of the big infections that are kind of, I want to say common, but they're not common necessarily. You know, common infections in the UK are things like urinary tract infection. But in terms of tropical fever, those are the sort of tropical diseases that you might be wanting to think about. So once you've got those in your head, you might start to come up with this framework of thinking about, okay, these are the common ones, but I know people abroad can catch the same things that you catch in Europe, UK. As I mentioned, urinary tract infection is really common. And actually, just because someone's been to sub-Saharan Africa or Southeast Asia, it doesn't mean that they don't have gram-negative sepsis with an E. coli from a urinary tract infection they've caught. It's about trying to process and following a stepwise approach to try and figure out what's going on. So if we go back to the case, we had the 27-year-old. Already we're thinking, young patient, do we tend to see things like urinary tract infections or pneumonia, severe pneumonias in 27-year-olds? It's not that common, right? So now we're going to start thinking about, right, how are we going to figure out whether it's any of these common tropical infections that we've just spoken about, or how are we going to figure out if it's some of these common infections in general? Stepwise approach, often everyone knows this stuff, history, physical examination. You want to try and consider local pathogens and the kind of season and everything about the country that the person went to. So the big key history point in this was Pakistan. So the question there is, what are the common infections to consider that we might think about in Pakistan? Or let me broaden this to Southeast Asia or the Indian subcontinent. So we've got our first bit of history, Pakistan. You think, okay, what kind of country is Pakistan? And whether it's rural, city-based, were there lots of rivers? Is it a kind of wet country? Is it a dry country? All these sorts of weird questions you might see to start with will define or help the infectious diseases physician and you as a medical F1 SHO on narrowing down your differential list. So I guess the first question that we always see is Pakistan, but do we know whereabouts in Pakistan? And was it mainly urban travel or was it rural travel? And if it was urban travel, was it involved in very deprived areas such as slums, or were they staying in very well-to-do kind of five-star hotels? So that's the first question I'm going to ask you.
So, I mean, thank you firstly for that fantastic summary. I mean, two points that I just want to pick out from my time that I think very much apply to what you just said. If there's one thing that's been, you know, hammered into me since I started infection training, it's malaria until it's proven otherwise. And as you said, malaria will present in many different ways, even as we sometimes see, even in baggage handlers. So not even necessarily in that person who's gone abroad. So yeah, it's always malaria until it's not. And I think for my first 4 years of practicing as a doctor, every fever in a returning traveller or an acute and differentiated fever actually turned out to be flu. So like you said, common things are sadly still more common than the zebras.
There's those hooves again, the horses rearing their ugly heads. And COVID is still a thing, unfortunately, as everyone knows. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But to answer your question, so we get a bit more travel history. So he was in Pakistan for 3 weeks in June and had been home for 48 hours before he became unwell. He'd initially flown into Islamabad, where he'd been in a hotel for 7 days, had explored the city with his family, but nothing that he described as an out of the ordinary in a city trip. He then went to Attock, which is west of Islamabad, for a week. And this is a more rural area where he stayed with his family in their home before he then went on to Lahore for his final week. And half of that was again in a family home and half was in a hotel.
Perfect. So mainly from that history, it sounds like he's in hotel-based accommodation for the most part. So why is this important? Why do I even care if he's been in hotels or if he's gone rurally or if he's gone urban? Well, we mentioned some of these big diseases. Well, these diseases are associated with certain risk factors. As I mentioned earlier, leptospirosis, the one that lots of people like to pick out, often associated with rodent urine and associated predominantly with water exposure, and considered historically as a kind of rural disease, although I don't think this podcast is long enough to discuss kind of climate change factors and urbanization factors, etc. And so it's probably a bit more urban than we used to consider it, but was once considered a kind of primarily rural disease. And so if you're staying in lots of hotels and swimming in what you'd hope to be well-maintained swimming pools, etc., etc., that might push you or might push your leptospirosis diagnosis a bit further down the differential list. Now, there's nothing to say that you can't find rodents and rodent urine catching leptospirosis from a five-star hotel. But obviously, if you're staying in, as I mentioned, a well-maintained hotel in whatever country you're staying at, that might make that diagnosis a bit less likely. And as we mentioned, we're trying to kind of push our differential diagnosis a certain direction. This is the same as something like dengue. So dengue, super common infection, viral arbovirus infection, and again, considered urban disease. But as we know, with urbanization encroaching on what was considered rural areas, that's becoming more of a peri-urban rural infection. And so although this might help, and we know with our case, it sounds kind of mainly urban, actually, because of the merge between kind of rural and urban centres, it's not quite hard and fast, but we've got urban. So the next thing to ask, the next framework I want to ask about this, so we know urban and we know Pakistan and we know the areas. So the next thing I want to ask is seasonality. And this is one of the questions that lots of non-infection doctors see and go, well, why the hell does he care if it rains or not? Is he just interested in weather? Actually, this is a quite important question because infections like previously mentioned arbovirus infection, lepto, already mentioned the water factor there, scrub typhus, things like melioidosis, all these infections that I mentioned tend to peak during rainy seasons, very similar to the big one, malaria. And so asking about seasonality like rainy season might help you push one way or the other. So I guess my question is it the rainy season in Pakistan around the time this patient went, or is it the dry season?
So it's just at the start of monsoon season, and there was a lot of rain whilst he was out there. And because, as you said, everyone likes to jump to leptospirosis, there have been some more questions asked specifically about things like fresh water. And he says, you know, he went on a boat once on the river, but there was no swimming in fresh water. And he doesn't remember seeing any rats and didn't have any particular interaction with any animals either. But he did eat street food, he says, whilst he was there, especially when he was in Lahore. But he thinks he only drank bottled water or water that his family gave him, and drank milk that, bemusingly, when you ask him, he says, I think it was pasteurized, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. But wasn't specifically on any farmland. But he does remember being bitten quite a lot by mosquitoes as well.
Perfect. So this is a fantastic entry into the next kind of category that you might think about. So just as a reminder, we thought about the country that the person's traveled to and the kind of regions where they've been, whether it's urban or regional. So we think it's mainly urban, and we think he traveled around the rainy season. OK, start of the monsoon. So that's important. So let's remember urban rainy season. So that leaves our kind of urban infections like dengue still in the differential. And that, again, rainy season leaves our wonderful leptospirosis still in the conversation, and whether that could have been affected with these various boat trips. Rohan has very, very nicely gone straight to the potential exposures. And so here comes the section where most people go, oh my God, what the hell are these questions about? And why the hell are the infection guys asking this? They make no sense whatsoever. Insect or mosquito bites, really important, biggest vector of disease that we have in the world. And so obviously you want to ask about the bites, because that's how you get lots of these infections. Malaria, dengue, chikungunya, Zika, etc. And so he said he thinks he's had lots of mosquito bites. So the next easiest question I like to ask alongside this is, was he wearing any insect repellent, or was he taking any sort of prophylaxis against malaria?
So he wasn't taking any malaria prophylaxis, but he did occasionally use insect repellent and was often wearing long clothing.
So that's a really important question. Obviously, this matters based on what country you've gone to. So if we change this case to he traveled to Belgium, I'm not necessarily going to be asking why didn't he take his malaria prophylaxis when he traveled to Brussels. But obviously, and I don't know every country's malaria risk off the top of my head either, it's best to look down and see, right, being bitten by mosquitoes, wasn't necessarily taking any prophylaxis. Is that a problem? Lots of different countries will have their own resources for this, but there is a gov.uk website that you can look at to see your kind of malaria risk by country and whether the risk is high, low, or no risk. So you can look through that and see, okay, are there areas in Pakistan that have malaria? We can certainly look through that map, and I'll get it up in a second and we can look through that. And then we can explore whether he saw which specific insects were biting him. So we mentioned mosquitoes, but obviously mosquitoes aren't the only insect animals on the planet. There are other vectors that spread different diseases. So I already mentioned rickettsial diseases, often associated with things like mites or ticks. So my next question would be, did he notice what sort of insects bit him? I know you mentioned mosquitoes, but were there any ticks, mites or fleas, et cetera, et cetera?
So he doesn't remember any other insects specifically biting him, and he hasn't noticed any bites that look out of the ordinary from anything else either.
Perfect. And so the fact that he didn't notice doesn't necessarily mean he has never been bitten by something like a tick, for example. Ticks bite you, or the aim of a tick biting you is to be completely painless. So often people don't notice that they've been bitten by a tick, but he hasn't noticed anything obvious. So that might tell you that are rickettsial illnesses as high up my differential? He hasn't noticed any, and it's sometimes worth asking family members if they've noticed any. And he was wearing long-sleeved clothing, which is a key factor to try and stop ticks from biting you. Now, obviously, just the fact you wear a long sleeve shirt doesn't necessarily mean a tick can't bite you, but it's helpful that you're wearing clothing that helps prevent ticks get to the skin, which is where they want to. So that might start pushing us away again from the kind of rickettsial illnesses. And we mentioned he was mainly urban again. So going back to our area of travel, ticks in hotels, not the most common. I'm obviously not going to lie about that, but you might start thinking about trekking through long grassland, long kind of tropical forested, tropical jungle type environment. And that would start pushing you towards that way. So we've got our insects. We think mosquitoes. So malaria, dengue, etc. We're still possibly thinking about. So the next question we talked about was ingestion of food. So why is that important? Well, we said there was some milk. Okay, so milk, unpasteurized milk or otherwise, is associated with certain illnesses. Big ones that we think about, Rohan, what do you think? What are the big kind of risks for milk?
So Brucella's always high for me, although you may potentially expect a longer history when you're thinking about Brucella, but Brucella's always up there. Listeria is another risk with your unpasteurized milk. Those are my big ones. Obviously, you can think about things like bovine TB. In certain animals, and those are the big ones that tend to come to my mind first of all when I think in particular about milk.
And what if I were to say the country he traveled to was the Middle East rather than Pakistan? And what if I were to say the milk in particular came from a certain humped animal?
When he's been drinking camel milk. Yeah.
It's still Brucella, but the key bit is not necessarily the milk, but the fact that you're around animals. And yeah, so
MERS as well and things like that.
Exactly. So Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome and about the animals that you're close to. So lots of people focus down
Q fever, etc.
So lots of people focus down on the milk, which is obviously important. And Brucella is kind of the key one that people tend to think about. But obviously, if people are interacting with animals that might produce the milk, we often think about in the UK about cows, but other countries, you know, will consume milk from other animals like camels. And so if there's lots of something like camel interaction, you might start thinking about infections that you might get from camels. So something like MERS. Okay. But we think cow, unpasteurized cow milk in this case, we think, but we're not sure. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, he thinks, I mean, it's milk that it was either in the hotel or is milk that was provided by his family. So, you know, if you were hedging, he would say he thought it was all pasteurized, his family drink it all the time, but he can't be 100% certain.
And we've got bottled water. Obviously, we're thinking, okay, bottled water for the most part should be quite safe, shouldn't it? That seems to be okay, but we have some street food. So he might not remember what type of street food, and I think he mentioned this already. Street food in general might push you towards a different avenue. So again, as you can see, we're kind of exploring all these different risk factors, and you could almost write the different key bits of history down on a list to see if that helps you. So far we have Pakistan, we have mainly urban, we have seasonality, so we think start of the rainy season, we have mosquito bites, we have water exposure, and we have ingestion of street food that we could either consider possibly contaminated or not fully cooked. So the classic with street food is there's lots of food in normally a stall, and whether you've consumed a bit that hasn't been as thoroughly cooked as some of the other bits, or whether you've got a bad batch of food. And actually, could you have caught something from that bit of food? So there's our next kind of keyword along there. But it's not just about whether you've consumed contaminated food or water, but whether you came into contact, as I mentioned, with stuff like camels or other animals, but whether also you came into contact with any sorts of fluids. And so the next question, we mentioned milk, but the next question that we tend to ask about is whether you came into contact with animal products other than milk, such as animal fluids, animal skins, any sort of other animal products that might have contaminated yourself, but either via eating them via your mouth, or whether you got any kind of skin cuts or got into your eye. So my next question would be any sort of animal products that he noticed that came into his body via either mouth, eyes, skin abrasions, anything like that at all.
So he did eat some meat when he was eating his street food, mostly chicken and occasionally beef. No other particularly odd or exciting animals that he ate. And he didn't come into contact with any skins or furs or any live animals at any point in his journey.
Perfect. And so the reason those sorts of questions might be asked, we already mentioned Brucella for milk consumption, but also whether we start thinking about something that I haven't even mentioned yet, which is the kind of viral hemorrhagic fevers. And so this is a very serious group of conditions that often in the back of your mind, you should be thinking about risk factors. And I'll come back to it probably at the end to try and discuss a bit more in depth about when you should really start thinking about this in forms of testing and informing various agencies about whether you need to test. But animal exposure can increase your risk of certain infections. So viral hemorrhagic fevers I just mentioned, but again, going back to our top five, which we're still thinking about, remember, we're still on the horses. We haven't left the horses to go to the zebras yet. So we're still horsebound and we're still thinking about things like leptospirosis or skin breaks, skin cuts. What about just a simple bog standard Group A Streptococcus Staph aureus skin infection? I can remember quite a few cases from A&E called to see someone who has traveled to some very exotic countries, many countries with lots of these risk factors we've mentioned, like water exposure, insect bites, etc. And everyone's missed the giant cut on the foot with a Staph aureus infection on it. So again, we're still horsebound. Please do remember that people traveling can catch normal infections just like cellulitis. So again, it's trying to figure out those exposures, whether that links. So for him, it doesn't sound like we're going to find the condition going down this animal route because he doesn't really have an animal exposure. So again, does that push us more away from something like viral hemorrhagic fever? Does that push us away from something like leptospirosis? It probably does. So moving on, my next question would be, when he wasn't in urban areas, if he was ever rural, or when he was in urban areas, were there any flooding? Was he walking barefoot? Did he always use shoes? Was he walking through agriculture? Or was it mainly urban throughout his stay?
So it was mainly urban. Attock is slightly more rural where he went for 7 days, but is still a small town. It's just not a big city. Always wore shoes. There was flooding around him, but he didn't walk through any. And in general, was pretty careful about things like kind of skin contact and any breaks in his skin or any scratches. And he didn't notice having anything like that at the time either.
Perfect. So often a question I tend to ask is, were people wearing shoes throughout or sandals on sandy beaches or soil? And that might be a question related to parasitic infections that you can catch coming through your skin. So a common one being something called Strongyloides that can access your body via your skin walking barefoot. But other conditions that we've already mentioned multiple times, so a watery environment, again, is the big leptospirosis. So when you're thinking about kind of watery environments, lots of vectors involved with water, mosquitoes and other conditions like that. So again, this sounds like we're going to move away from this area because he was well shooed, wasn't exposed to any sort of these water environments. Okay, so we still have our keywords. We think, in my head, I'm still thinking about the food because that sounds important to me. We're still thinking about the country. We're still thinking about the season. And in the back of my head, I've got he was bitten by lots of mosquitoes. So lots of conditions associated with mosquitoes that are arboviruses are still there in the back of my mind. So next then is, well, okay, I haven't really got my top one yet. So what do I need to ask to try and figure out how I narrow down to that top one? So next kind of on the framework is the onset and the kind of duration. How is this illness presenting? We already talked about a bit about it already with when it presented after his travel and how long it's been going on for. But I think it's important to kind of revisit that. We know diseases like malaria, for example, tend to have quite an acute onset and they tend to rapidly progress to complications over the first 7 days or so. And we know that some conditions like vivax and Ivali malaria tend to peak kind of every other day. Now people don't read textbooks and conditions and disease definitely don't read any textbooks. So this is not hard and fast rule, but these can give you a clue as to whether there's something going on like that. So I guess my first question is, was it an abrupt onset and did it worsen from that abrupt onset?
So it was a reasonably abrupt onset in that he notices that he, you know, the first thing he has is just is a really quite stonking fever. That's the first thing that he notices. And he even has a thermometer at home and has recorded it being above 39 on quite a few occasions before he came in. And he has this, and it starts 48 hours after he returns home. And then the fever is quite steady and constant. It's throughout the day, regular fevers. It's more than once a day. You know, he's having recurrent fevers throughout the day. And then 72 hours later, he develops some diarrhea and vomiting, and in particular notes that he's got some abdominal pain. And it's that side of things really not settling down. The fever's always there, kind of stays there the whole time, but the abdominal pain really gets to him alongside that diarrhea and vomiting that is what causes him to seek help.
Okay, perfect. So I mentioned at the start of this podcast that we're talking a lot about fevers without kind of any organ involvement. But actually, it sounds like we've got quite a specific organ involvement this time. So we've got abdominal pain and we've got diarrhea. So I just asked about peak temperatures and I just asked about abrupt onset. Well, it sounds pretty abrupt, so that hasn't really got rid of any of our other conditions. And it's almost like Rohan knows what I'm going to ask, because he's told me already the next question I was going to ask, which was about fever. So fever is an interesting one. High temperatures. Well, having a high temperature doesn't necessarily tell you which condition it is, but certain patterns about a fever might point you down a different direction. So we know malaria can give you a fever. We know things like scrub typhus can give you a fever. We know leptospirosis can give you a fever. But Rohan has mentioned something quite interesting. He's mentioned a very high fever. And he's mentioned a high fever that has been very steady for over 72 hours. Now, if I was going to think of one condition that might be associated with a very high fever going on for around 72 hours, associated with abdominal pain and diarrhea, and may I add, might be associated with no diarrhea at all, what would that big condition be? I guess Rohan knows the answer to this case already, but that would suggest something called enteric fever, okay? So our E of the M-A-E-S-R, enteric fever, salmonella, for example. And that's sort of a classic pattern for an enteric fever. We've hit a kind of key rule-in feature of a condition, and we talk a lot about rule-in and rule-out features, because remember, we're using this framework to try and figure out which of the many different infections might be affecting your patient with fever. And a kind of rule-in feature might be a very high fever for kind of three or more days with abdominal pain plus diarrhea or plus minus diarrhea and constipation, and that might rule in something like an enteric fever. Okay, so I've hit a key point of my pattern. Now I can go back to my framework. So I think, wow, I've got a key feature here for enteric fever. Does this fit with my story, or does this make complete nonsense? And therefore, do I need to go back again? So we go back to our keywords. What did we say? We said young 27-year-old traveled to Pakistan. Pakistan, a common area for enteric fever. Yes, Southeast Asia, Indian subcontinent, common for enteric fever. And by the way, I don't know the answers to this case. So if this is wrong, this would be absolutely fantastic for a podcast and show you how difficult infectious diseases is. But anyway, we'll stick with this. So enteric fever, Pakistan, young guy, Pakistan, traveled mainly urban. So eating and drinking, we think bottled water. So that's probably not so relevant, but eating street food. Okay. How do we catch enteric fever? Contaminated food and water. So contaminated food possibly still there. So we're still possibly on the right track. We know he's got mosquito bites. We know he was in the rainy season. Well, rainy season might suggest that lots of agriculture and lots of food stores have been contaminated with water. So actually, there's a lot of water that might help our possible diagnosis, but it doesn't necessarily rule it in completely. What do we think about the mosquito bites? Well, is that a red herring? Enteric fever not associated with mosquito bites, but you know, people who catch enteric fever can just get bites of any sort. So that's also fine. The lack of water exposure in general, again, pushed us away from our leptospirosis, and the lack of walking in rural areas pushed us a bit more away from our kind of other rural diseases. We've still got our malaria, because again, remember, everyone's got malaria. We still haven't ruled it out yet, really, but we've just hit our pattern. So now we're going to start thinking, could this fit with a normal gastroenteritis, abdominal pain, diarrhea, or is this one of our big five enteric fever? So let's have this on the back. We're going to stamp a big pin into our detective board now for enteric fever with malaria still there. But let's keep going. We haven't ruled out the other one. So my next question is, did this fever ever go away or was it steady?
Never went away.
Great. And how long has he had this fever for now?
So this is coming up to 10 days when you see him.
10 days. So this is important because I'm still thinking about my horses and my big conditions. And the next one on the list that we haven't talked about very much is dengue. Dengue, parvovirus spread by mosquitoes. He's had the mosquito bites. He's got a fever. But what you find with dengue is that people tend to have a kind of self-limiting course of a fever for kind of up to 7 to 12 days. And actually, lots of the severe symptoms of dengue tend to happen when the fever stops. And so actually for our patient, he's had an ongoing high fever for nearly 10 days. Now, this is possible with dengue. Again, dengue doesn't read the medical textbooks either. But lots of people who present might have what you consider a self-limiting course where the fever stops around day 7, day 8. Okay, so something to watch out for. So again, we haven't got rid of dengue yet. We might start be pushing away from it just ever so slightly. Some of our later questions might help with that. Furthermore, we mentioned flu. So Ryan, you mentioned flu. Lots of the cases you saw in your A&E talked about flu. Well, fever and flu classically lasts for around 2 to 4 days, really, is what you're tending to think. It can persist for up to over a week. But really, you're thinking kind of 3, 4, 5 days for fever and flu. And so the fact we've got 10 days makes me want to push away from flu. And flu, everyone knows flu symptoms because we define every other infection in the world by the fact that people have flu-like symptoms. And so flu-like symptoms include dry cough, myalgia, shakes, respiratory, so shortness of breath, carisal symptoms like sinus pain, runny nose, sore throat, etc. So any of those symptoms in our patient?
No. I mean, he says, you know, oh, he feels a bit rubbish all over, but nothing specific and certainly no carisal symptoms.
And so what about other sort of arboviral diseases that we might be thinking about? Well, actually, this bit of history has helped us with one of them, although again, because of the country that he's visited, I wouldn't necessarily be thinking about this as my top, but something like Zika, for example, just to mention, can sometimes have no fever or often a low-grade fever. And so the fact that we've got a very high fever that's lasted for many days might push us more away from the arboviruses now. And again, remember, we've got that pin in the enteric fever and we've got our little pin in malaria just to make sure that we haven't forgotten it, okay? The next kind of bit to mention just about fever before I kind of move on to my next category is what lots of people call relapsing fever and what you might see a lot about in history. So relapsing fever. So this is this fever that kind of lasts for 48, 72 hours, maybe up to 5 days. And then you get an afebrile period of, again, 3 to 4 days, up to 7 to 10 days. This relapsing fever is kind of a classic pattern for things like tropical Borrelias. So you're starting to think about your kind of rickettsial illnesses that you might have caught from ticks, mites, etc. So your scrub typhuses, your spirochetes can also do it. So things like the lepto again. But for this was constant. So again, we might have got rid of, not quite yet, but we might have pushed the rickettsias, the tropical diseases slightly away again. So the next factor is patient-related factors. This is, as you all know, common to any illness or any patient that presents into an A&E. You ask patient-related factors. So that's their past medical history, their age. Are they taking any medications? Are they immunosuppressed? Are they pregnant? I think I remember from the start of the case, this was a male, wasn't it? Not a female. So obviously pregnancy, not much of an issue here. But please, please, please do not forget about asking about pregnancy for obvious reasons. But also some infections can have much higher mortalities and much more serious consequences in pregnant women. We already know pregnant women that suffer malaria can have absolutely disastrous consequences and it can present very severely in pregnant women. So please, please, please obviously do ask about this or whether it's possible that they could be pregnant. Again, this might help narrow your diagnosis. So if you have a patient with diabetes, and I assume this patient doesn't, but maybe that's just an assumption, maybe he's grown up with diabetes. In fact, I'll just ask, does he have diabetes?
He doesn't. He's got no significant past medical history, isn't on any regular medications. And as you alluded to with pregnancy, I mean, the other thing that we should always think about for everyone is sexual history as well. And, you know, because in many of the same reasons that we talked about, all the other infections that you can get whilst you're abroad that can be much more common, STIs are also, you know, very common and easily acquired. You asked this as well, and he had a partner a year ago, and that was a regular partner for 3 months, had testing at that time, has had no partner since then, and didn't have any kind of sexual relations whilst he was abroad either.
Perfect. And that sort of leads on to the kind of next big question, is that every patient with an infection, you should be starting to think about conditions like HIV. Now, why is that important? Well, for obvious reasons, you have a patient with HIV, but HIV can lead to your differential diagnosis broadening. If you have someone who's very immunosuppressed, that might suggest that you have very different style of infection. So we know bloodstream infections with kind of non-typhoidal salmonellas, we know disseminated TB, we know deep fungal infections are more commonly seen in patients with HIV infection. And so obviously the presence or absence of HIV may well help you to differentiate diseases. But we don't have that, and we don't have diabetes. So that's fantastic. We know pregnancy can give you relative immunosuppression, and so will increase the severity of infections. I already mentioned severity of falciparum malaria. So fantastic. We've got none of those, which is great. So let's move on to the examination part. Now, I said at the start, a differentiated fever. Well, this is the part that might start helping you kind of localize your infection. You're looking for your, okay, are the sinuses infected? Is the abdomen infected? Are the lungs infected? Are the kidneys infected? Is there burning urine? Is there a skin lesion? Is there an eschar that might lead you towards something like scrub typhus? So I'm going to ask you a very general question, because we could spend hours just got on examination. But in general, skin, neurological, lungs, abdomen, any organ involvement. We mentioned a bit about abdo pain, but any other organ involvement that might help us narrow down to a disease?
Yeah, I mean, I'm already making you do a case via a podcast. I think making you do an examination via a podcast a bit is even harsher, isn't it, really? But I will give you some, I'll give you some important positives and some negative, you know, some important negatives. So he had generalized abdominal pain on light palpation, but no guarding. And you notice that there's splenomegaly present. So he's got moderate splenomegaly. He looks mildly jaundiced. He's got some ecteric sclerae, but he's got no eschars, no obvious bite marks that you can see, and he doesn't have any joint swellings that you can see on examination, and the skin looks intact.
Skin looks intact as well. Fantastic. So I'll mention a few key kind of findings there. So I mentioned eschars. I'll be looking for eschars if people travel back from certain countries, and this is because it can lead you to something like scrub typhus or something like pick typhus. And so eschars, kind of a classic kind of black looking lesion on the skin. Be very careful when you're looking for these, because they can hide in the hairlines. And so obviously it's about checking the full body, obviously chaperoned, to make sure that you're not missing any sneaky eschars that might be hidden. But again, so skin is normal. So I think we can start moving away from our rickettsial illnesses so far on the examination. Next thing to talk about is something like eyes and mucous membranes. This is the one that I find people tend to forget about the most. I'm not sure why, but people tend to not look in people's eyes or mouths. And it's really important, because you can get some very clever or very key findings from these. And so talking about eyes, we want to look for whether the eyes are red and whether there's kind of any swelling there or any discharge, and what we might, or any something like jaundice. And what we're really looking for is something called conjunctival suffusion, which might suggest something like leptospirosis, or we're looking for a conjunctivitis, which might suggest an arbovirus. So in the eyes, any eye findings at all in this patient?
So just the ecteric sclerae, but no suffusion that you can see. It's just they're slightly ecteric.
So next we're thinking, okay, that's kind of ruled out or pushing us again away from those illnesses. So we still have our pin. So don't forget, we're going to come back to our pinned condition. So that's still there. Next is the kind of, we mentioned the skin and rashes. So please, 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 everyone, whenever you see someone with a fever, please look for rashes. Now, rashes can be tricky because you can get a rash just because you have a fever. But there are some very specific rash patterns, such as rash plus pain in joints, or what we call a polyarthritis. Now, this is a common finding with arboviral infections. Dengue can very much present like this. Chikungunya can present like this. So again, the rash in dengue will tend to appear on your trunk, and it tends to appear around 5 days after the fever started. So we know we're at day 10. So if we're thinking dengue, we should really have a rash now because we're 10 days after the fever. So any rash in the skin?
No rashes. And I think it's a really important point you make about looking for rashes, because I think one thing that we're also particularly bad at, and partly because of how our training works and all the lovely pictures we have in dermatology textbooks, is looking for rashes always in people of colour, and always taking actually that, I think, that extra time to examine in those situations when the rash might not be typical of what you've learned or you can see online. I think it's always worth double checking and making sure. But in this case, absolutely no rashes.
Perfect. So that's really pushing us away from some of the arboviruses now. I said we hadn't really ruled them out yet, but that's really kind of pushing us away now. We're day 10. And so we might want to start asking about other sort of rule out signs to do with the examination. So we mentioned lymphadenopathy. So any large lymph nodes anywhere, the presence of a rash or lots of big chunky lymph nodes would make our thought process about malaria quite unlikely. Malaria shouldn't really give you quite a significant rash and lots of big swollen lymph nodes everywhere. So any swollen lymph nodes anywhere on an examination?
No lymphadenopathy.
Perfect. And so if the answer to that had been yes, I might have had to take my pin out of the condition. So I'm very glad you said no lymphadenopathy. So that's good. So lymphadenopathy is very, very uncommon in something like enteric fever. And so that's a good answer from Rohan there for our differentials. Jaundice, any generalized jaundice? We mentioned enteric sclera, but any generalized jaundice?
Yeah, so he looks mildly jaundiced as well. You know, you're not looking at him and going, wow, he's bright yellow, but there's definitely some jaundice present that you can see.
Okay. So now we're starting to think about, again, we're thinking about our organ involvement and which one of these conditions might give you organ involvement. The kind of reflex for any sort of possibility of liver involvement makes people jump towards your kind of viral hepatitises. And I don't think that's a wrong jump, because obviously we can diagnose that by sending off certain blood tests. But there are lots of other conditions that can affect the liver, one of which is enteric fever. And another one that we've always talked about quite a lot already is something like leptospirosis. So I would encourage people to always think about viral hepatitis. It's very important. But a high fever plus jaundice might actually push us towards something like leptospirosis or enteric fever, as well as some of the others like malaria. So please do test for viral hepatitis, but don't use a jaundice patient with high fever as your kind of key. Oh, fantastic. It's just hepatitis A from the food that he's eaten. Okay. Right. Investigations time. What sort of investigations do we need to kind of help our pins? Well, this is where you're ruling out infections for the big ones. Malaria is still pinned, remember, might help us. So I would like to know the routine bloods. And obviously, when you get called from A&E, this is almost always what you will get. So you'll get a full blood count, you'll get a renal function, and you'll get a liver function most likely. So can we have some of those, please?
You've got his white cell, and it's 12 with a neutrophilia. His hemoglobin is 100 with platelets of 93. And you assume and you think that all of his old ones are normal. He doesn't have any old ones on the system, but he's not had any kind of particular medical contact. So you'd assume that they would be within the normal range. His liver function shows a bilirubin of 180, an ALP of 100, and an ALT of 100. And his renal function shows he's got a urea of 15 with a raised creatinine as well at 170. And his potassium is 2.7 and his sodium is 130.
Okay, perfect. So let's talk a bit about these very basic kind of blood tests, because I think this is quite important and it can help you guide towards different types of infection. So we often talk about high white cells, low white cells, platelets. We talk about presence or lack of eosinophils, which I'll come to at the end. And we talk about various biochemistry. So let's start off with the full blood count, because Again, this is commonly a test requested before you've even seen or even heard about the patient. And actually, that can help guide you towards one or other of the infections. The presence or lack of anemia with a rising hematocrit. There we go. That's the one. So we often do see anemia in patients with something like malaria. We also see a rising hematocrit in patients with dengue. So right away, looking at hematocrit might help us go towards malaria or dengue. In this patient, sorry, forgive me, I've completely forgotten what you said about the full blood count for anemia and hematocrit.
So hematocrit's within normal range. His hemoglobin is 100 and the platelets are 93.
Perfect. So that brings us on to the next part, which was low platelets or thrombocytopenia. So thrombocytopenia can be seen in all of the kind of common infection syndromes that you might get from a tropical country. But something like a low platelet count plus a large spleen, which we had, might suggest malaria. Low platelets and something like bleeding can be seen in dengue or other sort of VA or viral hemorrhagic fevers. But the presence of that tends to be quite unusual in malaria. So low platelets by themselves doesn't necessarily discriminate what's going on. Low platelets can happen in all of them. But the presence of something else, like we have splenomegaly in this case, might suggest something like malaria. So we still have malaria there. What about the white cells? Can the white cells help? Well, high neutrophils might help suggest it might be a bacterial infection. We see high neutrophils and lots of bacterial infections. Can it help us define which one of these infections it might be? So high white cells we can see in leptospirosis, we can see it in enteric fever, especially in children, and we see it in something like scrub typhus as well. So your kind of rickettsial illnesses, you can have high white cells, but you can have low white cells as well. Low white cells, moving on, if you had someone with lots of low white cells and thrombocytopenia, which I just mentioned, that's kind of a pattern key with dengue. So we don't really have that pattern here. We have high white cells, suggesting maybe a bacterial infection, and we have low platelets, which may well fit again with our pinned infection, our kind of enteric fever bacterial infection. Just a quick mention here, this is when you want to request your blood smear, because this is really important. I haven't even looked at the renal or liver function yet. All I'm doing is looking at the full blood count, and I would like a blood smear because, again, we still have not ruled out the big one that we want to. So can we have our blood smear? Hopefully a blood smear will help us look for something like malaria, but it can also help with some very other weird infections like malaria, borreliosis, South American trypanosomiasis, et cetera, et cetera. So can we get a blood smear, please, before I even move on to the next ones?
Yeah, certainly. You don't see anything on your smear, and on the film they note some left shift of neutrophils, but nothing else particular. And also excitingly, because A&E have been very switched on, your RDT for malaria has also come back as a negative.
Okay, perfect. So this, depending on which institution you're staying in. Some institutions are much better at looking for these than others. And I guess it would be remiss of me not to recommend that if you're in a hospital where you think you might have malaria and the hospital departments are a lot less comfortable with looking for malaria, please, please, please do call the Hospital for Tropical Diseases or in London and or in Liverpool and ask for your smears, your blood samples to go to the parasite lab there, because they'd be very, very happy to help look for malaria on these smears. So don't feel alone if you're in a department that's not comfortable or not experienced in looking for these things. You can have them sent off. So please, please do ring those numbers and contact them. I guess we can put the number for that at the end of this. It'd be helpful for people. So
yeah, definitely.
Don't worry if they can't be done in your hospital. We can help with that at these two laboratories. But having a negative smear and a negative RDT for malaria, super helpful, because remember, we still had a little pin on malaria. So actually, this helps us kind of move away from that completely. So let's move on to the next sets of blood tests that we already had. This helps us not only assess for organ dysfunction, and if we'd had a positive malaria, would help us define whether it's severe malaria or not severe malaria. It can sometimes help us focus down again on the condition. So something like renal and liver involvement we see commonly in malaria, but we also see it in rickettsial illnesses. We see it in leptospirosis. Whilst if you had a kind of lung or a renal type syndrome, you might also start moving away from things like dengue, and you might move towards something, again, like the scrub typhus, rickettsial, and leptospirosis. Renal function can be important when combined with other things. And we know with the test that you just described that we had raised liver function. So I guess I want to ask you a question now, Rohan, about liver function. What do you think about raised or abnormal liver function and how helpful it can be?
So I think the way that I tend to approach your liver function is you've got to think of it in two ways. Obviously, you know, we always talk about when you're thinking about liver failure, you think about actually the synthetic, you know, components. So thinking about your INR and your albumin when you're actually looking for liver failure. And then I also like to think about, especially in infection, when we talk about, you know, how is this interacting with the liver? In particular, when you mention things like your viral hepatitises, you know, that's where I'm really looking at the ALT in particular and where I'd expect to see the biggest change or the biggest differential. And in a case like this, the bit that's actually most out of whack, for example, your bilirubin and your ALP, you know, for me, that always points to more of, oh, actually, could this just be a systemic condition that's affecting the liver, as opposed to necessarily this is a liver-centered process that's going on?
Yeah, and that's a really important point regarding whether the organ is the main primary focus of your infection or whether it's associated with just a very unwell patient. So although this might be a bit of a segue, thinking about diarrhea, which we know our patients had, diarrhea can often be the localizing factor when it comes to the organ involved for a condition, or diarrhea might not be the focused organ involved at all and actually is a feature of a very unwell systemic patient. So it's always worth thinking about whether the organs involved are the primary source here or whether they are just abnormal because the patient is just very, very unwell. So really good point about the liver. So we've done our kind of basics and we've done our smear, which has helped us with our malaria diagnosis. And so we're happy that it might well not be malaria. We could always repeat these if we're not completely happy. And don't ever be afraid to repeat something if you're not quite happy with the result that you get back, although I'm sure your labs might not like you having 10 different malaria films on the same evening. But please do repeat these things if you're not sure. For the sake of the podcast, we'll say negative for malaria, which makes us feel a lot more comfortable about that. So we might be able to take our pin out then at that point. So how do we move forward towards the rest of our infections? Well, we do lots of common things for infections. And again, I still haven't jumped on the zebra yet. So I would quite like some blood cultures. We have a patient with a fever. I want to make sure there's no sepsis. So I'd like some blood cultures. He's got diarrhea. So I'd like some stool cultures. Please don't forget the viruses. We can test for lots of viruses on stool. So I'd like to send the stool for viruses. And that's key because lots of people forget to send for viruses. They often send it for MCNS and a culture and forget to send it for viruses. So please send the stool for viruses as well. I'd just like some simple sepsis investigations like a urine culture. He's not describing any urine symptoms. And in a 27-year-old without any unprotected sexual intercourse, it'd be quite unusual to be getting a urinary tract infection in that age group. But I think for completeness, we should send off a urine culture. So can we get a blood culture, a urine culture and stool culture? And for the sake of increasing this investigation point of view, you can send tests off in the UK, at least, off to the Rare Imported Pathogens Laboratory, where they can test serologically for various number of infections based on the locality the patients travel to and their clinical details. It's important to say things like rickettsia, which you can look for on a serology, like a IgM, IgG, can be sent off, but they can also test PCR on certain samples. So very important to start thinking about that if you have a patient where you're not quite sure what's going on. Have a chat with one of the Ripple doctors. I know them very well. They're fantastic, lovely people who are super knowledgeable and not only would be delighted to speak to you on the phone about your patients, but also can recommend some tests that you can send off to them. So again, we'll put that number at the end, but we can test for these serologies. So what I'd ask you, Rohan, is could we send off these cultures and these serologies and whether or not any of these help us with our diagnosis? Now, remember, with all of these, we've sort of gone away from malaria. We've still got lepto in there, but it's not sounding like that to me because remember our keywords, where they've been, We've moved away from dengue because we don't really have any clinical signs for that one. Our rickettsia, we've got no eschars. We've got no real risk factors for the rickettsia so far. So I'm still pointing my finger on this enteric fever and or a regular bacterial sepsis. And so hopefully, if my suspicions are correct, we should have either a blood culture, and please do send multiple sets of blood cultures. One set is never enough, and or a stool culture with a positive result. So let's see what we've got to. Rohan.
Well, first, I'm going to be really, really harsh and say that actually, you know, you're very diligent. We make sure that all of this stuff gets sent off. But actually, you're just coming to the end of your shift and you have to hand over. And sadly, this stuff isn't back until you're going to walk in the morning. But you've got this person in front of you. Is there anything at that point in time you want to do to manage that patient before we get all of our lovely results the next day when you can finally find out if your pins are in the right place or not?
Obviously, lots of these tests, especially these tests that you might send off to a reported pathogens lab, they're not going to call you and go, oh, great, we've got the result for you this morning. So even if it is one of those, you're not going to find out straight away. So how are you going to manage these patients? Well, actually, this is just general medicine. This is how stable or unstable are your patients. So are there any red flag, what we call red flag features, that might suggest that you need to manage this patient in hospital and therefore admit for observation and or treatment? Or is this patient actually really clinically quite well? And actually, yes, they've got a bit of diarrhea. Let's say the fevers have settled by now. Their blood tests have come back actually pretty okay. There's not really any abnormalities. And so could it have just indicated something like a Campylobacter gastroenteritis? Really common from food. I would say we wouldn't see this level of fever ongoing with such deranged blood tests. And so actually something like a simple or even viral gastroenteritis shouldn't really be presenting like this. But if he was someone like that, actually, could you send them home and wait for those tests to come back? So it's a clinical judgment at this point. How stable, how unwell is this patient? Obviously, the patients we want to keep an eye out for are our severely ill patients. And this is common. So low blood pressure, tachycardia, tachypnea, lactate suggesting that there's some acidemia going on there. Drowsiness. Now, what can be useful, we've already said it's probably not malaria, but actually how you define severe malaria is kind of a head to toe process. And what I tend to think about is going from the head to toe. And when you're thinking about non-severe versus severe malaria, if you have any sort of severe organ dysfunction, that suggests severe malaria, but you can apply that to any sorts of infection. So going from head to toe, are they drowsy? Is their GCS a lot lower than should be expected? So we have a 27-year-old with no past medical history. His GCS really should be 15 out of 15. And so if you have a young gentleman who's got GCS of kind of 9, well, actually, you might be thinking, hang on a second, high fevers, GCS of 9. He also, when I went to examine him, I didn't notice this before, but his neck was really stiff. Oh, actually, this guy needs admission. He needs an urgent lumbar puncture and possibly antibiotics to cover him for meningitis. But as you go down, you go from your head, the mouth, don't forget the mouth, neck, chest. Is this guy really shortness of breath? Is he requiring really high levels of oxygen? Well, obviously, if he's got sats of 80, you aren't going to be sending him home to kind of breathe room air at home. So obviously, it's just your generalized medical review to see, is he stable or unstable? So I guess my first question to you, Rohan, on examination is, do we think we've got a stable patient here or an unstable patient here?
We've got a stable patient. I mean, our big concerns are he is slightly hypotensive, although his heart rate's only at 85 and his BP is 110 over 70, but he's stable. And his renal function is the other big, you know, anomaly that we feel that he probably has to have managed whilst he's here, but he is stable. And obviously his electrolytes, as we spoke about as well, were a little bit low, so he may need some help on that side of things. But you do your head to toe, you're quite happy that, yeah, okay, he's not well, but he's definitely stable. But you think, yeah, this is a guy who needs to stay in and have a bit of support from us, in particular with his renal function in the way that it is.
Okay, perfect. So we've made the decision to admit. We've told our colleagues, we've called our rare imported pathogens laboratory for the load of testing. We sent all our cultures off. Now what do we do? We've seen that the malaria tests are negative, so we don't necessarily need to initiate malaria treatment off the get-go. But I'm still worried about that pin. I'm still worried about bacterial infections that I can treat. But I'm still not quite sure what the diagnosis is yet. So what you'll see is lots of infection teams will often give people antibiotics that cover lots of different organisms when we're not sure. And actually, there's been various different, phrases and various different plans done by bacteria societies. But one of a common one is something called start smart, then focus. But you can substitute that in with various other phrases or taglines that you would like. But actually quite a nice combination of antibiotics that might cover you for some of the common bacterial infections is something like a third generation cephalosporin, so something like ceftriaxone, for example, which would give us cover for, we've pinned it, enteric fever, but it would also cover other organisms like leptospirosis. It might help us cover gram-negative sepsis that might be making this person unwell, but it doesn't cover everything. Bar something like resistant bacteria, it doesn't cover things like rickettsial infection. And so this is when we start adding in something like doxycycline. Doxycycline, by the way, is the infectious diseases doctor's favorite antibiotic because it tends to cover almost everything that you can think of. And so often we call patients with fever of returning travelers doxycycline deficient syndrome because we like covering everything until we can pin our hat on something. So often you'll see ceftriaxone and doxycycline as your first empirical bacterial and rickettsial cover for a patient coming back from the tropics. So we think he's unstable. We think he may well have a bacterial infection. And so giving ceftriaxone and doxy might well be sensible. But there's a big but in this one. What is my big but when I'm talking about ceftriaxone and doxycycline and antibiotics in general, Rohan? Do you know what my but's going to be?
Oh, your big but. I was going to say, well, I was going to ask firstly, you know, is there anything about the place he's been that may even make you think about the antibiotics potentially slightly differently? But your big but in terms of ceftriaxone and doxycycline.
I'll jump in there and say my big but was exactly what you've just said. So it's really important to be aware of local resistance patterns. So we are quite lucky in the UK compared to many countries with some of our resistant pathogens. And so let's take the example of MRSA, was the big, scary, big bad many years ago. And actually in the UK, compared to countries like Spain, Italy, and the US, for example, our rates of MRSA in our patients are much lower. And so actually for us in the UK, if it was infection caught in the UK, maybe we wouldn't be covering something like MRSA. But in these other countries, actually these resistance patterns are much higher. And actually we know he's been to Pakistan, and thinking about our fevers in returning travelers, we know since around 2016, really, and maybe even earlier, that conditions such as typhoid fever or enteric fever, what we're thinking about, we do have examples of extensively resistant typhoid fever showing up in Pakistan. And in Pakistan, we know that these have required the use of either carbapenem treatment, so meropenem, or something like azithromycin. And so either would you tailor your antibiotic therapy here to something like ceftriaxone and azithro, knowing full well that azithromycin might not cover some of the other rickettsial illnesses as well as doxy, or could you just switch the ceftriaxone to meropenem and continue the doxycycline until you have your results back? And actually what I find is that we know an area like Pakistan does have resistance. If you're seeing a patient in A&E that is unstable or unwell, starting smart may well be starting on meropenem and doxycycline and then narrowing down afterwards. If your patient is stable and well, actually you might well have time to see if it's a resistant pathogen or not. But where they've been is really, really important. And so for our case here, Pakistan, we know there has been multiple data sets showing there is extensively resistant typhoid fever. And therefore, in our patient to start with, whether we would go for a carbapenem to cover him, considering we still think enteric fever is in our list of pathogens.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the keys that I would always say to anyone of, you know, if you have any doubts, in particular when it comes to travel-related infections, problems such as this, you know, Alex and I work in infection, this is great for us. But if it's something you're not particularly comfortable for, get in touch, give us a ring, because, you know, always there's help. And these are the types of things that we will have thought about and had time to maybe think about that won't necessarily cross the mind of everyone kind of practicing at the front door when they first see that patient in front of them. I'm going to answer your pins now. So you come in the next morning and you find out that there's a blood culture which grew gram-negative bacilli after 10 hours. And it goes in its four-hour moldy, and it's Salmonella enterica serotype typhi. And you even get a positive stool culture as well. So your pin was pretty spot on right from the beginning, I have to say.
Well, that's very nice to hear, number one, that I haven't gone completely crazy. But I guess the key, again, is kind of going back to our keywords. And this is the way I was always taught as an SHO and a registrar. But thinking back to our algorithm, we wrote down those keywords. And so once we've got the diagnosis, does this whole syndrome fit with this diagnosis? Well, why did I say enteric fever in the first place? I said enteric fever because the area was correct. So we know that lots of patients coming back from that area can be affected by enteric fever. But not everyone goes to Indian subcontinent, Southeast Asia. What if they've been to Eastern China, Hong Kong, and they've been to an area where there's a severe pneumonia and or a severe outbreak going on? So this is the point to emphasize that you want to start looking at where they've been and whether there's something going on there at the time they've been there. It doesn't take an absolute genius to look at a country on something like, and here I'm going to give ProMed Mail, NAFNAC, any of these sorts of websites that talk about outbreaks. If they've been to an area that's got an ongoing or current dengue outbreak and they present with rash, high fevers, mosquito bites, low platelets, actually, the diagnosis before you ask anything or do any blood test may well be dengue, because there's lots of dengue cases in the place they've gone to. Similarly, if you think about the big viral hemorrhagic fever outbreaks, we're thinking about Western Africa, thinking about DRC. If they've been to an area where there's an ongoing and increasing number of cases of something like a viral hemorrhagic fever, well, actually, you might well think about that instance. So the country or the place and within the country where they've been was really important. And in this case, it's a classic area for enteric fever. So straight away, Pakistan was a really key point. So remember to put those keywords down: Pakistan, urban, high temperatures for over 3 days, abdominal pain, some diarrhea, and that has led us to enteric fever. So try and put those kind of key points down and review with your results whether or not that fits. I mentioned flu because if you've been to it, obviously with an area of flu, everyone remembers antibiotics, but please don't forget about the antivirals. Antivirals can be important. So obviously, if you've been to a flu outbreak area and you present very acutely, then you might be available to have some sort of antiviral like oseltamivir. So don't forget about antivirals as well. Finally, I haven't really touched on this, but there are some zebras out there. And the zebras to us might be horses in those places. So I have mentioned something called melioid, but if you've been or they've patients been to an area where melioid is common, and don't forget in some places of the world, this is a common cause of chest infection or pneumonia, this might tailor your antibiotics. So if our patient had been to a common melioid region, thinking kind of Northern Australia or Southeast Asia, we might start on an antibiotic that would cover melioid to cover the chest. So if their chest symptoms have been to a common area of melioid, we might tailor it. So again, remember countries, look at the country they've been to, check on these websites to see what sort of infections are common in those areas and whether or not there's an outbreak of the infection in that area, and that use that to help tailor your investigations and then your management. And remember, you can always review your management. I think in medicine, we always think, well, I've got to get the right answer straight away. I mean, I've even done it in this podcast. I'm going, oh my God, what if I get it wrong? That's fine. You can always review what your diagnosis was. And actually for infection, the response to the symptoms with the antibiotics can help. Did the fever respond to the antibiotics you gave? Now, we know with something like a rickets infection, which we still wouldn't have had our results back from our lovely reference lab yet, they normally respond to the correct antibiotics within 48 hours. So our patient has been in for 48 hours and they're still having fevers, they're still unwell, or they're worsening. Actually, have I got my antibiotic combo wrong? And have I got my diagnosis wrong? Obviously, please do consistently review your patient to see, are they improving? So at the 48-hour mark, has my patient got better or are they getting worse, and or are there any further tests I need to do at this point? Now, in our case, obviously, we have a salmonella. But as I mentioned, in Pakistan, we have resistance problems. So I've got the salmonella, which is great. But actually, do I need to see how the patient does on the combination we've started, and or wait for the sensitivities before I start chopping and changing? So the next part of it would be, on your re-review 24, 48 hours later, how is our patient doing?
You know, luckily in this patient's case, he's doing very, very well. And actually, it's remarkable it comes back as a fully sensitive salmonella, almost unheard of, I would speculate, from that area. But I just want to pick up on a few things that you said, Alex, that I think are so important just to emphasize. And I think one is, you know, the resources that anyone can access. So, you know, you spoke about NathNat Travel Health, you spoke about ProMed Mail. I'd even throw in, you know, the CDC is a very easy website, as is the WHO disease outbreak website. And I think anyone can check those. And if you've got a patient that comes in, it's very easy to check those. And importantly, I think it emphasizes the key in that travel history of making sure you really pin down where people go. Because, you know, it won't, for example, just say outbreak, you know, the entirety of Pakistan. It will probably, you know, it will be on the Pakistan page, but it will also say the specific area. And that's why it can be so important, as well as for labeling your specimens when you send them off to our fancy reference lab that we're lucky to have access to. You know, they will run the geographical panel, but they will run it based on the travel history that you provide. So the testing can only be as good as the history that you take and the history you provide. And I think the other thing is, you know, we've presented, you know, and I love that bit that you say about reviewing, because we've presented quite really, in a way, a straightforward case, and probably more straightforward, if we're honest, Alex, than a lot of the people present. And two that come to my mind are, you know, I remember a patient who had a similar presentation to this and ended up actually having HLH secondary to typhoid, and, you know, required going down that whole pathway of management, even though the typhoid was being successfully treated, already started on the HLH pathway, and had to have that management side of things done. And, you know, if you're interested in that, please listen to our HLH episode that we've done previously. And another one where we had a patient, you know, they'd had a short course of amoxicillin from a GP. They hadn't completed it. They think about 3 days. And then because they felt so unwell, had come into hospital. But it was just enough that it suppressed most of our diagnostics until we eventually got a stool sample back kind of a week later, which confirmed someone had Salmonella paratyphi. So I think that bit about reviewing is so important, because, as you say, it's never that clear cut. It's very rare that you will get, you know, as straightforward a case, if you like, as the one we've done. You know, it often does have some bumps in the road where you have to go back, look at everything you've done, and really talk to your colleagues and work out the best way to go. But never be afraid of either changing course or, you know, going over what you've done before, because there'll always be something that you can find out that you didn't in the first time.
Yeah, I think that's really smart advice. And please do always review. Please do always ask for help. There are lots of people around. I think when people become consultants or think about being consultants, that actually the consultant has to know everything. Actually, even as consultants, we, surprise, surprise, we talk to each other quite a lot. And I often ask other people for advice about infections and cases. And actually, people are generally very nice and very happy to help, and often can help you guide down the right route. So please never be afraid to, even as if we've got some consultants listening, please never be afraid to speak to other specialists that can often help you with your sort of diagnosis. So I think we've covered most of the points about this case. The last thing I guess I want to leave you all with, the good resources that we briefly mentioned, but if anyone's more interested in kind of fevers and returning travelers and investigations, there's an absolutely fantastic paper that we used before doing this podcast. There's a BMJ paper and chart. It's called Assessment and Initial Management of Acute Fever in Tropical Subtropical Regions, and it's absolutely fantastic and takes you through that sort of framework that we've kind of briefly gone through. And I often use it as a nice reminder to make sure that I haven't forgotten anything and looked into everything. And last but not least is the viral hemorrhagic fever, which I promised I would come back to. So this is the big bad that everyone is in infectious disease is absolutely terrified about. And I think it's really important to have this in the back of your mind when assessing patients, because I think there is some fear, especially among infection juniors, about even raising this as a possibility. And I'd like to try and dispel that fear. So viral hemorrhagic fevers, of which there are many, but I guess the most popular common one is Ebola. But diseases like Lassa, Marburg, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, etc., are all part of this kind of group. And the reason it's so important is because identification of these illnesses early is exceptionally important in terms of infection control and how you review and manage these patients and whether or not you need help in. So we often use tools that are provided by gov.uk. Again, you can go on there and look for viral hemorrhagic fevers risk assessment. As I mentioned before about help, again, calling your local, or in the UK at least, the rare imported pathogens laboratory, who can often advise about this with your clinical features, to try and see, could your patient that has returned from a country have a viral hemorrhagic fever? So the useful questions to ask yourself in these scenarios is, does your patient have fever? Now, this sounds like a stupid question to start with, because the whole topic is about fever from returning travelers. But actually, that's important, because viral hemorrhagic fever, you should have a fever or history of fever within the previous 24 hours. If that is not the case, then you can be very, or at least pretty certain, it's not a viral hemorrhagic fever. Makes it very unlikely. So the next question is, has the patient developed symptoms within 3 weeks of leaving a viral hemorrhagic fever endemic country? And this is where it'd be very useful to use resources that I mentioned before. So ProMed Mail, NathNAC, the gov.uk website, where you can see which countries are associated with previous viral hemorrhagic fever outbreaks and or are undergoing a current viral hemorrhagic fever outbreak. I mentioned earlier in the podcast, obviously, if you meet to somewhere like Democratic Republic of Congo, which might have an ongoing viral hemorrhagic fever outbreak, actually, okay, they've been to the right place. If they've been to Belgium again, okay, well, that doesn't really fit with a viral hemorrhagic fever outbreak. So again, country, really important. And was it within the incubation period? So was it within that time frame of 3 weeks? If not, you might move on to the next risk factors. And this is where our kind of risk factor questions come in, and some of the weird and wonderful questions that you might see from an infection history. So we mentioned the outbreak. Has the patient worked in kind of basic rural conditions, or lived or had an overnight stay in an area where Lassa fever is endemic? Really important, because actually, if the country has had known outbreaks before, or at least is geographically next to countries that might have had this, staying in rural basic conditions where Lassa fever is endemic might put you at risk for contracting Lassa fever. So that question is very important, because this is one of the common ones that we can test for. And actually, you can figure out the risk just by asking that one question. My next favorite question that people always seem to ask first, which I think it's a bit odd. I tend to start with the kind of more common horse questions, but a fantastic zebra question is, has the patient been in caves or mines, or eaten animals such as primates or bats? So a fantastically infectious disease type question, but when it comes to viral hemorrhagic fever, very important, because if you have been around bats primarily, or eaten primates, come into contact with caves, that can put you at risk for some of the viral hemorrhagic fevers like Marburg, like Ebola. And obviously, if this is within a country that is known to have that, if your answer to that is yes, well, that may well put your risk up a notch. The final kind of one of these high risk questions is, has this patient traveled to an area where Crimea Congo hemorrhagic fever is endemic and sustained a tick bite, or they noticed a tick and they crushed it in their hands or pressed it against their skin, or have they been involved in the slaughter of animals or around human deaths in funerals of a patient that was suspected of having a viral hemorrhagic fever? Again, if the answer to this is no, then that might push you away from the viral hemorrhagic fever. But the answer is yes, you will then want to risk stratify towards possibility of viral hemorrhagic fever. So those questions are key into starting to think about, could this patient have possibly contracted this serious illness that I've already mentioned is readily transferable to other people, and therefore you need to institute your infection control protocols in your local hospital? This is the part where people start getting a bit afraid, because patients with a fever, really common. Patients travel to areas that have had endemic parahemorrhagic fevers within 21 days. They come back within 3 weeks. Okay, really common. So I think for our patient or other patients coming to A&E, that lots of patients will fulfill those criteria. So those questions are really, really key. If it's no to all of those questions, you could then start to ask, okay, does the patient have lots of bleeding or bruising, or have they come into contact with someone else who's got all of the same features? If that question is yes, I think at that point you might consider, hang on a second, could this still be your viral hemorrhagic fever? At the very least, this person needs to be in a location where, if the tests come back as positive, you haven't spread it around to the rest of your A&E or your ward. It's at this point where you've got your possibility of viral hemorrhagic fever that one of the first investigations you need to send off is your malaria investigation. So, as Rohan mentioned at the start of the podcast, everyone has malaria until proven otherwise. And so your malaria test needs to be sent off, because the problem with malaria is that it kills people. And obviously, if you're waiting for your viral hemorrhagic fever test that you've sent off to come back and you're not giving someone with malaria the treatment, well, the malaria will affect their health and therefore make them unwell and possibly kill them. So please do think about malaria even in these patients and initiate malaria treatment based on, obviously, on the results. So malaria is the next key part of this. If the malaria fever is negative, or even if it's positive, that doesn't necessarily mean it's definitely a viral hemorrhagic fever. But if malaria is positive, you might start thinking, well, actually, all these symptoms might fit with malaria. And actually, do we even need to test for other conditions? And the key question at this point is, have they returned from a country that has viral hemorrhagic fever endemic or epidemics ongoing? If they don't, which you should have asked in one of those four big questions to start with, well, actually, you should manage as malaria, and that makes viral hemorrhagic fever unlikely. If they have, people are allowed to have two or three infections at the same time. So it's all about, have they been somewhere where there is an epidemic or a high number of cases of viral hemorrhagic fever, and have they got malaria plus another one? And it's at this point where you want to get help if you need to. You want to call your rare imported pathogens laboratory, speak to your infection teams, and decide what the kind of risks are based on whether you need to leave your patient in a scenario where you, the staff, and other patients are protected. So using PPE, I'm sure everyone's used to PPE now with COVID, but specialized PPE, and making sure that you're doing everything possible to stop the transmission of a condition that might then happen. The next assessment I find quite useful is looking again, this extensive bruising or bleeding, or any sort of uncontrolled symptoms of fluid expulsion. So you're thinking of vomiting, diarrhea, etc. Because this is the main way that viral hemorrhagic fevers are spread, through fluids. And so if the answer for that is yes, they've been to a country where there's an ongoing epidemic, endemic, even if the malaria is positive at that point, you might say, well, hang on a second, this could still be a viral hemorrhagic fever. I'll phone my colleagues at the fever service, discuss the clinical features. And at that point, they might suggest non-urgent testing or urgent testing. That can be discussed with the laboratory. You get a test, and then obviously it's negative or positive. It's at this point, when you're thinking about testing and thinking this all fits, that you definitely need help. And so I would recommend speaking to the laboratories that test this to get help, because they might suggest to you, actually, this doesn't sound like it at all, or it does sound like it, and therefore we should test, and you should keep your patient, who's now on malaria treatment, within a side room and continue your protective equipment for your staff and patients. So that's the kind of risk algorithm, and there's a very nice algorithm you can look at from gov.uk or on the Ripple website. And it's very easy. It's a nice flow chart, and you can just follow that flow chart. But again, if any part of it does not make sense and you're concerned, either speak to the infection team in your hospital, or if you are the infection team, again, speak to the laboratories that have got a wealth of experience reviewing clinical cases and testing. And so please, if you start thinking about viral hemorrhagic fever, you think it could be possible and you want to test, phone a friend. Really important bit of advice.
Yeah, and I think that is the best bit of advice, is that you're not alone in any of this at any point in any specialty. And even if you are triaging that person in ED and you're the first person who's thought of it and going through that first bit of the pathway, you know, even if that becomes a stumbling block, just call, you know, as Alex says, your local infection team, but call someone and talk it through with them. And most people, you know, they're happy to help, and most people want to help and will be happy to go through it with you so that you can try and get to a kind of sensible outcome and the best decision for your patient. And so I think what Alex said as well is, it's not, you know, or people don't like raising it, don't like thinking about it. It shouldn't be that way. You know, if you think about it, that's fine, but just make sure that you've thought through it. And if at any point that causes a problem, just phone a friend, and we're always here to help, and we're always quite excited to help generally when it comes to infection.
Please do discuss it with your local infection and microbiology team first before phoning directly from your A&E to them, and discuss it with the infection team first. And if your local infection team are still concerned, obviously at that point you would phone on. So yeah, please do discuss it with your infection team, and then obviously that can be escalated afterwards if there's still that concern.
Yes, that's a very good point. Thank you very much, Alex. That has been an incredible, incredible run through of fever in the returning traveller and how to approach that acute undifferentiated fever. And I just want to say thank you once more. And I think just to emphasise the big learning points for me that I'd like people to take away from this, always phone a friend whenever you're in doubt, in particular your local infection team. Check out those resources for seeing where people have travelled, and we'll put links to those as well as to the viral hemorrhagic fever algorithm, so that people can have a look of that if they've not come across it before. And yeah, thank you for listening. Alex, any final thoughts?
I think that was a very nice summary. And whatever you do when you assess these patients, just have a nice framework in the back of your head to work through, because there's lots of infections, there's lots of problems, and actually following a nice framework algorithm can help you diagnose and stop you forgetting things. So yeah, but finally, I'd say thank you for asking me on to talk about this, and I hope the listeners find it useful. So thank you very much.
Hey, you're more than welcome. And yeah, I think that it's a very important point you make about not forgetting things like MERS or Q fever when it comes to camels. And on that note, thank you for listening, and we welcome any feedback on our website via the submission page. Please let us know if there's anything you'd want to feedback on this episode, or any future topics you'd like to hear. Bye. Thanks for listening.
Bye. Thanks.